No. Whoa. Hi. Yay.
Can you hear me now? No.
Okay. Holding a microphone. Hi. This is Introduction to User Freedom. I'm Molly DeBlanc, and this is Karen Sandler.
A quick introduction about us. My name's Karen Sandler. I'm the executive director of an organization called the Software Freedom Conservancy. We are a nonprofit charity and the home of almost 50 free and open source software projects. Stuff I see some people applauding. stuff you're using, like, for example, Git, but tons of other projects too. We're also the home of Outreachy, which is a diversity initiative. And we are also the ones who enforce the GPL on behalf of Linux kernel developers who ask us to, and a few of our member projects. And I'm interested in all of this in large part because I literally have a big heart. My heart is 3 times the size of a normal person's heart. It's called hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, and I'm at a very high risk of suddenly dying. So I have a pacemaker defibrillator implanted in my body, studying my own defibrillator and how defibrillators work made me passionate about the safety of our software generally, and it turned me into someone who thought that open source was cool and useful into someone who thinks that software freedom is essential.
I'm Molly DeBlanc. That's my Twitter handle. That is my personal Twitter, not my work Twitter. Actually, the bottom one is also not my work Twitter. It's, in fact, my personal StatusNet account, so you can reach me in either of those places. I'm the campaigns manager at the Free Software Foundation, so I do organizing and education around free software and free software-related issues. I also serve on the board of directors of the Open Source Initiative. So what is user freedom? User freedom, thank you. User freedom is the idea that we have the right and the ability, well, we should have the right and ability to choose and understand our technology, that when we're using it, we're consenting to it enthusiastically. And as part of that, we need to have autonomy over our computing. And as part of that, we need to have the knowledge to understand and make conscientious decisions.
And then the ability to make those changes and have control over our software and all of our technology that we use.
Our rights extend to digital spaces. The idea of digital rights, especially in this context, is that in the regular world, we have all of these rights and freedoms that we've agreed upon, and that just because we're looking at a different framework and working in a different paradigm doesn't mean that it's actually that different.
The frameworks that we've already established for the way that we communicate and the way that we interact with society are well established, and we shouldn't think of them as completely new ideas just because we have new ways of doing it. We should apply our rationale for these strong ideas around privacy and all of the other rights and freedoms that we expect in that same overall context. I know this is a very savvy audience, I think, compared to many others. But there's a knee-jerk reaction to say, we do everything so differently now. You know, people say, we didn't used to have email, we didn't used to have, these platforms that we communicate with each other. So we have to think of completely new ways of thinking about important issues about our technology and about our society. But what I found to be most useful is to go back to, well, how did we used to think about doing the same thing and applying that to a new framework and trying to find a rational way to map that out.
Cool. So what is software freedom?
There's a nervous silence in the crowd, like you might not know the answer.
If you don't know the answer, that's totally okay, because we're going to explain it to you.
Yes, and I would say that a lot of people get involved with in the field and are active in free and open source software, and many of them haven't taken the time to step back and think about what that means and how that plays out. So I really love this this image, which is, I think, from a FSF t-shirt.
Yes, you can, in fact, get it upstairs in the expo hall or whatever that's called.
That's a shameless plug.
Yeah.
It's a good shirt.
You should
shirt. Absolutely
I
buy
have
that
one.
Shirt. I love it because I think it shows us very explicitly what these four freedoms mean. So we generally think of four freedoms with respect to our software: the ability to run the software, to use it, the ability to edit it and make changes, the ability to contribute, and then the ability to not just share the original copy or the original version that you're using, but also the ability to share the changes, the modifications that you have made to the software.
Cool. So free software is necessary for user freedom. Is there
something on the next slide, or is it this slide? I forget.
We're just going to sneak peek.
Yes. Great, thanks. Free software is necessary for user freedom. Software freedom is this tool that we've created to help protect user freedom. One of the things that free software does and means is that we can look at these things, we can take them apart, we can understand them, and we can't consent and we can't consent enthusiastically to using software and using technology if we don't understand and if we can't understand what's going on for it. So one of the ways somebody recently gave me really good language for this, which is that software freedom enables user freedom.
Yeah, I like to think of it as software freedom being at the service of all of the other freedoms that we need. Software freedom is an essential tool that we need to accomplish our protection and make sure that our technology is ethical. It's like a cornerstone piece of ethical technology.
So another way to think about this is by using the example of a terms of service, right? So a terms of service, usually when we see them, and we see them every day, or many of us, some of us, people see them every day, and agree to them, usually without reading them, because they're these complicated, crunchy things that make no sense. So terms of service really needs to be clear and concise for us to be able to click I agree and do so in good conscience. However, that is not what happens. And the same thing is true with technology. It needs to be something that can be interpreted and understood in a clear and concise manner in order for people to be able to click I agree in good conscience. This particular image is an art piece from Dima Yarvanovsky called I Agree, which printed out several different terms of service from websites.
And I should interject here. I'm also a lawyer in addition to being executive director of an organization. And this is not legal advice. Why you would think it was legal advice, I don't know. But it's not legal advice, and I am not your lawyer. But to do a slight legal rant, which is that I cannot believe that these terms of service are, in fact, enforceable, and I've been really floored by the evolution of our case law and contracts to uphold them, because if you look at these terms of service, they're just outrageously long. A professor published a paper that showed that you would have to read for months in order to, like, consistently every day reading these terms of service to just agree to what the ordinary person agrees to in their ordinary course of dealing. And as a lawyer, I try to read as many of these terms of service as possible, but it's simply impossible to read them all. It's a bit baffling how we could be in that situation.
You still get other things done?
I try.
How does software freedom protect user freedom?
So having introduced myself as a lawyer, and nobody threw anything at me, so that was pretty exciting. So free software is predicated on copyright. Raise your hand if you have read a free software license at some point. So it's like 3/4 of the audience. Raise your hand if you have never heard of copyleft, and it's totally okay, because there are always people who have, you know, you have to hear about it. Raise your hand if you've never heard of copyleft. So a couple of people. So free software is totally predicated on a legal concept. And the idea is using copyright, but to keep copyright, which generally restricts software and restricts what you can share it. Copyright creates effectively a monopoly over the work. Copyright applies simply when you write the software, when you write the copyrighted work, it arises. You don't have to do anything to get it. If you fix your work if you fix a work of tangible creative expression, that is when your copyright arises, and it's a very low bar for copyrightability. And so once you have that copyright, you can use that copyright / monopoly-ish system, but to share your work instead. And that is where these free and open source software licenses come to play. So free and open source software means software with those freedoms that we identified before, the ability to use, to share, to make changes, and to share those changes. What those licenses do is they provide a legal framework for doing it, and there are a variety of different licenses. There's the two general categories are copyleft and non-copyleft. And copyleft is a really cool concept. It's the idea of using copyright, but to keep software free and to keep. So in other words, if you use a copyleft license, you say you can do whatever you want with this software. And this is really shorthand. But you can do whatever you want with this software, provided that if you make changes and distribute those changes, you do so under the same license. So it's a detractors have called it viral in the past. But now viral is actually a good term. But I like to think of it as forever free or a snowballing effect. So once you release your software under a copyleft license, it creates this body of software that grows and grows that many people contribute to. So the very nature of free software, of free and open source software, is predicated on a legal hack. And it's I think it's a really cool one.
So the way that we define what counts as a free license or an open source license is that we have put our trust into two organizations, the Free Software Foundation and the Open Source Initiative, who each maintain a canonical list. So the Free Software Foundation maintains a canonical list of free software licenses, while the OSI maintains one of open source licenses. What we've done is these organizations look at how a given license that's proposed to them fits into maintaining software freedom, and then makes the decision to either approve it or not based on that criteria. So when something is calling itself free or open source, when it's using one of those licenses, that's when we know that there's really integrity in the technology.
Those license lists are predicated on definitions. So those two organizations, actually Molly's affiliated with both of them.
I'm doubly qualified to talk about this.
And I'm simply pro bono counsel sometimes to the Free Software Foundation. That may mean that I'm not qualified at all, since I don't have any position of authority at either organization. But that was a bad joke. Those lists are predicated on a review of the definitions. There's an open source definition and a free software definition. And what's interesting is that the open source definition comes directly from the free software definition. So they're not like two separate things that have been developed independently. The open source definition was originally came from the Debian free software guidelines, and that was a way to write down an interpretation of the four of the free software definition. And so both have kind of been tweaked a little bit in the interim, but generally those license lists are overlapping. There are a historical one or two instances where something might not be approved by both, but if it is approved by both and almost all of the licenses that appear on one appear on the other, you can pretty much know that it's free and open source.
And if you'd like to talk about Debian's role in this later, both Karen and I are very enthusiastic about the Debian project and happy to talk about it.
Which brings me to the discussion of terminology of using free software, using the term open source software. I do want to take a note and say this because I think many people have only heard the term open source. And what I have found in the course of my work in this field is that different people think that they're saying different things when they say free software or open source software, and what they think they mean differs from person to person. So I've heard people think that free software means a copy software released under a copyleft license, and some people think open source is a non-copyleft license, or some people call it permissive or lax permissive. Some people think that free software refers to ideology and open source only refers to collaborative business models, but I've heard this, but some people use open source as an ideological description of what they're doing, and some people use free software to describe all of the use of free and open source software in the field. And so often I like to say free and open because both terms are sometimes a little bit, if you look at them on their face without the knowledge that we have, you might think that that open source, for example, only refers to being able to look at the code, not necessarily having any rights to modify it. So I think it's just very, so long as we are very clear that we are talking about freedom, I think that that's the most important thing. I like the term software freedom. I also work at the Software Freedom Conservancy, but there are other software freedom organizations. But I think as long as we're very clear about what we're talking about, I think that that's what really matters.
Cool. So free can also mean a few things. People say free as in beer, but I'm trying to move away from that and make free as in coffee happen. So if you want to make that happen with me, that'd be really great. So when we say free software, a lot of people actually interpret the word free in a variety of ways, all of which are accurate to some extent, depending on the case. So a lot of free software is gratis. It's available at no cost. All free software is free as in freedom, and a lot of free software is also free as in kittens, where you see this thing and it seems really great, and then you take it home and suddenly you realize you need to maintain it and feed it and take care of it, and sometimes it will still come and try to eat your face in the middle of the night.
I would say that outside of English, other languages don't have this problem necessarily. Some languages have the term Libra or an equivalent, which stands for freedom. But I found that in the US, if you talk about Libra software, people think you're talking about their horoscope. Software freedom is, as I said, essential. We're both, you know, really dedicating our lives to working on free software. So it's great, it's important, but it can't be the only answer. So we know that all software is vulnerable. Just because software is free and open doesn't mean it's better or safer. It actually makes it very tough to explain the issue and tough to advocate for it, because I want to stand up on stage and say, free software is awesome. It's better. It's safer. If you use free software, everything's going to be fine and excellent. But the truth is that all software has vulnerabilities and all software has problems. The thing is, what do we do when we have a problem? And that's where software freedom really matters. So I think that you have to view software freedom in the context of our overall technology and understand that it's not the only thing. It's a cornerstone of ethical technology, but it can't be the only piece of it.
So why is user freedom important? Karen?
Well, user freedom is important to me because I have this defibrillator, right? I mean, so addressing my own mortality and finding out that I had a 2-3% chance per year of dying and that it compounded and being diagnosed at age 31 was extremely daunting. I'm a very logical and fact-driven person, and the stats on my longevity were quite alarming. And the doctors said, but it's not a problem because you can have this defibrillator and then everything will be fine. And to which I asked, well, what does it run? And they said, run? And I said, well, yeah, this device has software on it. And they said, software? And so having this software literally sewn into my body and screwed into my heart has made me realize that having some kind of control over it, not even being able to look at it and knowing that that software is in my body, has been a really poignant experience. And once you have that experience, it's a very short walk from medical devices to cars, in which we entrust our lives every day, and from cars to voting machines to stock markets. And while we live in an Internet of Things, where we're only as safe as our weakest link, suddenly, while everything is talking to everything else, much more of our software becomes really important from a critical security and a personal view. So for me, it is just this deeply personal issue that I basically can never escape.
So before writing this talk, I thought I cared about user freedom and software freedom from this very high view of society and how as a society we're at risk and technology is this extremely pervasive. Technology is so pervasive. It's everywhere. In Karen's case, it's in her body. I think my knees are going to get replaced someday, and who knows what they'll be doing with knees at that point. You know, it's in our pockets. How many of you have a device on you that's really a computer? Yeah, I think I don't right now, but mine's right here, so it's nearby. So I used to think that I really only cared about it at this level, and in doing this talk, I realized that I actually have this like extremely deep, visceral reaction and understanding that so little of my experience actually belongs to me, and so little of my experience is something that I'm controlling, right? And whether we're talking about the promoted tweets that we see on Twitter, which like I definitely look at and use a lot. to things like even what's controlling the streetlights outside. Like, these aren't experiences that I have ever really been given the opportunity to consent to other than by deciding that I want to interact with the world.
Yeah, I think we're all in the process of becoming and unbecoming cyborgs in different ways. For me, my technology is always implanted, but we interact with all of our technology in different ways, and that line, that blurry line between where we end and where our technology begins, gets blurrier and blurrier every year.
So there are also a lot of personal reasons why you should care about software freedom and user freedom if you don't already.
So one of them is the right to repair or to have your technology repaired. A lot of cars, for example, today rely on proprietary software, and you have to bring your car to your dealer in order to get your car repaired if you have a problem, which means that you have to rely on an authorized dealer and not be able to repair the car yourself. You wouldn't necessarily even be able to go to a skilled mechanic who didn't have a license from that car manufacturer for the proprietary software, and worse still, you may have to bring it to a dealer, but only certain dealers. So the right, and I love using the right to repair as an example of why you would care about user freedom or software freedom, because gosh darn it, it's so American. I should have a right to repair my car or my tractor or my heart device or anything that we possibly rely on.
They're specializing the tools to fit your needs. I think this is one that matters to a lot of hackers, especially when you're using something and it's not quite working the way you want it to. One example of this is key bindings, right? So if you want to change your key bindings, if you want to make it so that when you hit caps lock, it does something different than make the letters all big, that's a key binding.
In general, for safety and security and trust, so we cannot have companies, single companies in particular, be in control of our basic safety and security. What we have right now is the exact... We've got it all wrong. Right now, we have mostly devices that have proprietary software that we can't review and we can't control and we can't change when something goes wrong, but we also have no appreciable security on a lot of those devices. My defibrillator is a good example of that. It has no encryption, no password protection. It's the worst of both worlds, right? What we need is real security and also free and open source software so that we can have some control over our basic technology. Most of the great security tools are based on free and open source software, or free and open source software, because you can't let one entity control the keys only. What if that company gets purchased? What if through no ill will the company goes out of business? I want to make sure that my defibrillator, for example, isn't controlled just by a single medical device manufacturer.
There's also trusting who's in charge of a company. You might have one particularly great CEO or CTO or COO or see something else who's like taking these great ethical stances that we all get really into. But then if it switches and someone else is in charge, suddenly everything might change completely.
So here's a great example, and I wasn't planning to talk about this, but people, many developers who were committed to freedom had no problem adopting GitHub and just put a lot of their software on GitHub. And then suddenly, when GitHub was acquired by Microsoft, there was an uproar about whether or not that was the end of the trustability of GitHub. But once you entrust your software to a system like that, you know what you're getting. And there's no slight on either company. It's just, it is what it is, right? And if you you just have no idea what's going to happen to a company down the road. I think the very idea that I'm just going to say, I don't think that Microsoft is any different than a lot of the companies that are proprietary software companies that use free and open source software in our field. But somehow the people react to the name and the history. And I think that that it's just a great example of, you don't know, it could be an acquisition by another company, but it could also just be a change in leadership. So we have to be very forward-looking with respect to who we trust for our software and our technology in general. And similarly, the right to privacy is by definition such a personal thing. I know that, for example, my defibrillator by default would be broadcasting. And so when I got a new defibrillator last year, I had a hard time finding one that was not constantly broadcasting. So if anyone's trying to look for my defibrillator, I was able to disable my my wireless component in software. But I got the only defibrillator available in the US market where you can do that. There was only one, and it was only made available by a small in the US manufacturer, which to me is terrifying. We're connecting all of the things. We don't even realize what's talking to what technology is talking to other technology. And the fact is that people don't even realize that that they're broadcasting in this way. We need a right to not broadcast, but we need to examine our right to privacy in this overall ethical technology construct and think about user freedom accordingly. And it's a real reason why you should care about user freedom.
There. Freedom of expression and safe spaces, so safe spaces to develop those ideas is also predicated on software freedom and user freedom. I'm sure for many of you in this room, I know for myself, a lot of my ideas have really been developed in digital spaces, whether it's been on IRC or over Signal chats or WhatsApp. And I need to have those spaces in order to develop my ideas and in order to be able to communicate things and communicate them safely and confidently. And if we can't trust the tools that we're using to have these conversations, then we're in a pretty dangerous place, it turns out.
Yeah, I want to add that it's not necessarily free software and user freedom doesn't necessarily software freedom doesn't necessarily make the space free. I do want to acknowledge that we sometimes have toxic personalities in the field, and they don't necessarily create safe spaces, but you can't have an overall framework of safe spaces and free speech without free software fundamentally. And the thing is that we don't even know how a lot of our technology is going to be used. So, for example, when I got my defibrillator, I don't want to say how old I am. When I got my first defibrillator a while ago, I thought that it was more about auditability, and I didn't. I thought that my story was basically done. But as I've lived my life with my defibrillator, it's become relevant in unexpected ways. So, for example, I was pregnant, and about a quarter of all pregnant women have palpitations. That means their heartbeats kind of fast from time to time with a little bit of irregularity. And when that happened to me, which is perfectly normal, if you were someone without a heart condition or without a defibrillator and you went to the doctor and you said, I've been having these palpitations, a doctor would generally say to a pregnant woman, oh yes, pregnant women often palpitate, don't worry about it. But for me, my defibrillator thought that my heart was in a dangerous rhythm, and so it unnecessarily shocked me twice. And so I got shocked twice because my device was trying to deliver me unnecessary and unwanted treatment. And the only way to avoid that was to take drugs to slow my heart rate down so much that I could barely walk up a flight of stairs. And when I looked into it, I thought, this can't be right. It's so common for pregnant women to have palpitations. But it turns out that fewer than half of all the people who get defibrillators are women. It's in like the low 40 percentages. But more importantly, 85% of the people who get defibrillators are over the age of 65. So the set of people who are pregnant with defibrillators is just tiny, and being pregnant is a temporary condition. I promise you that the device manufacturer has no interest in having pregnant ladies getting shocked. It's like any medical device company's worst nightmare is having their pregnant patients getting shocked. But it's just not on their radar screen. They just aren't thinking about it because my use case wasn't I wasn't the intended audience of my device. And this defibrillator, the representative tells me it should last 17 years. A lot of our technology is going to last a long time. We're putting all this technology, especially connected technology, in our security systems, in our refrigerators, in all kinds of light bulbs, all kinds of devices that we're surrounding ourselves with for these long periods of time, and we have no idea how it's going to be used. It's going to be impossible for us to predict the problems that are going to arise. And more so, the companies that made these devices are going to go out of business. Their products are going to end of life. The developers who worked on it at those corporations are going to find new jobs, and those companies are not going to keep great records. They're not going to keep good source code internally. If we don't get the complete and corresponding source code for all of our technology, we'll never be able to fix the problem as they happen, and those problems are getting more and more complex by the day.
The need for user freedom is by definition extremely personal, so I hope each of you in this room either have or will have soon your own reason why user freedom matters to you. And this could be because, like Karen, you have a heart condition, or like me, you're scared of what's going to happen in the future to society. It could also be because maybe you have a sibling with an accessibility issue, and you're very concerned that the technology currently doesn't meet their needs. It could be because you just have a specialized need for your own tools and you want it to work a little bit differently than it currently is. But these are things that I really hope you'll be thinking about and coming up with. So in addition to personal reasons why free software matters, there are also lots of societal reasons, right? So racial justice. I'm not an expert in racial justice or race issues, but I do believe that that is, in fact, a user freedom issue. When we look at how algorithms and AI are really becoming this integral part to a lot of how society is working, whether or not we're looking at something like automatic faucets in bathrooms that have trouble recognizing people with darker skin tones, or you're looking at, say, like when Google facial recognition software was confusing African Americans with gorillas, which is something I hope you know about, and if you don't, you should read about it. I hear the problem's been fixed. But these are race issues, and these are free software issues. There are also issues of economic justice. This is thinking about, so when you think about economic justice, I want you to think about the economic inequalities that exist, and the ways that we are currently interacting with them, how many of them are being driven by technology, whether or not we're looking at how immigrants who are coming into the United States are being assessed. With ICE recently, it came out that the algorithms they were using and the checklists they were using to determine who was being allowed into the US were redone secretly so that it listed everyone as a potential threat who needed to be detained. But they weren't talking about the people who are doctors coming over from England. They were talking about the people who have different socioeconomic statuses.
And then there's an important education component, because software freedom, and it's connected to some of the economic arguments as well, but with software freedom comes the democratization of technology. So with software freedom, anyone can access their software, which allows them to learn and to be able to participate, even if you don't have the money to buy proprietary software licenses. Raise your hand if your first software thing that you took an interest and dug in on was connected to a game. I know what mine was, a quarter of the audience. I used to think that games weren't that important to the story of software freedom because I was focused on these societal issues, but of course games are a way that a lot of people get involved, and if there's software freedom connected to those games, it allows people to dig in and to bring that into their education. It's really important that educational institutions have access to different software and control over their software.
Now we're going to talk about companies, corporations, and governments.
Money. Everybody likes money. companies are really interesting because they have a real stake in free and open source software. Raise your hand if you have a company, you have a job that, raise your hand if you have a job that you have to, you use or develop free software in some way. And that's like more than half of the audience. Companies care about free and open source software because it's super useful to them. It's very hard to get to market without without using a tremendous amount of free and open source software. And they have a vested interest, and they want to control the the software that they're using in their products. But their interests may not be aligned with the public's interests. So, what they're focused on may not be apply to every use case. And through no ill intention of those companies, they may do things that are in fact not at all what we want. So it's great that they're so invested. We need companies to be using free and open source software in order for us to succeed as a movement, because if companies aren't using free and open source software, then we're left with products without free and open source software. But at the same time, we have to sort of step up and make sure that we demand more freedom in our devices.
Freeing code also matters with things like Uber and PayPal. These are actually two kind of divisive examples, but when you're thinking about platforms, it still matters, because if we're willing to give up software freedom at one level, then the question is, where are we going to be drawing the line? So either you might say, well, PayPal is dealing with a lot of secure financial data, and it's like, great, well, maybe cars should also be something that we don't have access to, because cars are multiple ton killing machines that are going around on the streets. Or, well, if we're gonna also then have cars as this protected class of technology, maybe we should, and then you just kind of work your way down, and then suddenly you actually don't have any software freedom anywhere.
Oh yeah, this is the picture of the cat guarding the fish store. We just need to make, sure that that we give ourselves the power and the tools so that we can influence that gatekeeping and make sure that our technology has our interests at heart and also the corporate interests, because companies will find a way to profit off of the software that we make available to them, but we don't necessarily have to give too much. And as Molly says, it's a slippery slope. So making sure that that we stand firm and demand freedom wherever we can is really important.
There's also, to take this idea of corporate stuff to with another example and a personal issue, this is aripiprazole, also known as Abilify, which is now available with a sensor in it. The sensor then will talk to your phone, which will talk to your doctor and inform your doctor when you've taken it and how long it's taken to disperse into your system. So this means you have, like, there's a bunch of things wrong with this, right? and to very quickly try to go over them because we're running low on time. So this is trusting the security of your phone, for example. Your phone is, like, a part of this process. And that's, like, super scary already because we're having trouble trusting things like voting machines. Then we want to look at, like, trusting your doctor. One of the things when we talk about software is on proprietary software, is we talk about lock-in and how once you're using a piece of technology, you might not be able to use another piece of technology that does effectively the same thing because of file formats, because all of your history is built into this one tool. And it's kind of the same thing where you end up in a situation where maybe you have to keep using the same doctor, even if that doctor is not the right person for you, because they have access to all this information and you've built up this particular reliance with them.
I'm locked into my defibrillator because it's sewn into my body, but I should be able to choose whatever medical professionals I want to be able to adjust it, and right now I can't.
Cool. So this is representative of the government. I'm glad someone laughed.
I'm here for you, Molly.
Yay. I'm actually not going to talk about governments being evil. I'm going to talk about production of software. So in the US, we have this really great thing where things that are produced by the government belong to the people. This should also be true for the code produced by the US government. We're kind of lucky in that there's this thing called the called the Federal Source Code Policy, which is beginning to tackle that issue. But it's also important to make sure that the fundamental technologies that we're building everything else on that's governing us are free and respect us as users.
One of the great tools that we can use in order to help us with making sure that there aren't shady things happening in the background is Copyleft, which is the licensing tool that we talked about before. Copyleft, which requires that if you're distributing the software, that you distribute along with that software the source code or an offer to that source code that is good and exercisable. And what's important about Copyleft is that it helps if someone is using the software in a dubious way and you can examine the source code, you stand a chance of possibly being able to find it and possibly being able to modify it. It's not a slam dunk. Again, I really want to say that free software is just better and safer. period. But these are complicated issues. There could be backdoors that we don't pick up when we review the source code. But once we find out that there's a problem, being able to identify it and being able to do something about it is only possible with software freedom.
When I talk with people about licensing and license approval, one of the most common things I hear is, well, what if I want to, well, I want to make a free software license, but I want it to include a clause saying do no evil. That's kind of why we have copyleft. It doesn't actually keep people from doing no evil, but what it does mean is that if, say, a government is doing something totally insidious with a technology that's already free software, that's already copyleft, they then in turn have to share what they've done. This doesn't protect you from what's been going on, but it does make it so that you can know what's happening and hopefully give your consent.
And it's not necessarily connected to copyleft generally, but the GPL suite of licenses is great. And I should mention, actually, that Software Freedom Conservancy is license agnostic. We are home of lots of free and open source software projects. Some of them are copyleft, some of them are non-copyleft. But personally, what I like about the GPL suite of licenses is that it requires complete and corresponding source code. So it's the complete source code and the scripts to build and install it. And that's really important for having any appreciable freedom with respect to the software we use.
In summary, we like copyleft.
Big fans. Recommend it.
Cool. So there are lots of things that you can do to help free software user freedom and software freedom. Here's a wonderful list. We are basically over time.
We've got a few minutes for questions, but we can run through these really quickly.
You can work on projects.
Please ask questions. Nobody wants to be the one creating that terrible dystopia that we're going to live in. So if you're working in a technology company, ask questions about the ethics of the products you're working on. Ask questions about the software and the software licensing. A question can really just change the tenor of the conversation.
Teach others. This means teaching others both about user freedom, but also about free software. Helping them learn to use something can make it easier and a lot less scary. And it's also an important step in the proliferation.
And advocate. Don't just take these ideas for granted.
Use free software tools. Use free software tools in your life and when you're building free software. Because if we don't have good free software, we're not actually going to be able to get anybody else to use it.
Please negotiate your employment contract. A lot of people take jobs and with the understanding that they're going to work on free and open source software in their jobs. Ask for that to be put in your contract. Consider asking your company if you can hold the copyrights that you write within the context of your employment. Having that conversation can really propel if companies want to recruit the best talent, and if lots of developers or contributors are asking for these things, companies will start to move in order to attract better talent.
You can ask Karen about this later with Contract Patch, which is a conservancy project. Shameless plug. And on the note of shameless plugs, you can also support organizations with both time and money. Organizations like the Software Freedom Conservancy and the Free Software Foundation are member-driven, where lots of our funding comes from our members, our member donations, and our member fees and support.
We simply wouldn't survive without donations from individuals, but enough shilling.
Yes. Okay, 5 minutes left.
Thank you very much.
Oh, sorry. And thanks.
And we'd love questions if you want to queue up at the microphone. That would be great.
I also especially encourage questions from people who don't normally ask them or haven't asked them before. And if you make a statement, not a question, I'm going to interrupt you. So if you've never asked a question before, just jump to the front of the line.
I haven't asked a question. So, Karen, can you just tell the technical details of how you were able to disable the wireless module on your defibrillator?
So I wish that I were able to do it myself, but the truth is that I, so what was fascinating was going into my electrophysiologist's office and saying, okay, so here are my issues. And so first I was like, okay, I want to get a device manufacturer where I know I can get access to my source code or at least have the ability to negotiate it. Can you help me with that? And they were like, I guess. I don't know. And then I said, and I definitely want to be able to disable the wireless functionality, preferably in hardware. And I heard that Dick Cheney had it done. So that wasn't the case when I heard. So can I have that too? And I got laughed at, basically, because that is not something that you can do. And what the device manufacturer, what the technician did with me was she called all of the device manufacturers on speakerphone with me, which was amazing of her. And I was able to go through each company and ask them about the, do you have any that aren't broadcasting wirelessly? Can I disable it in hardware? Can we do that prior to getting it implanted? And the answer was, no. Are you cutting me off?
Yeah, you can learn more about this story from Karen Sandler's keynote at LinuxConf Australia 2018.
I just want to say that Biotronic said that their devices were hack-proof.
Nice. Thank you.
Hi. We seem to be in a state where the default licensing model is the users can't do anything except what they're told they're able to do. Are you aware of any licensing models that are the opposite, where users can do anything other than what they're told they can't explicitly do? And do you know why that's not a more common model?
The only thing I can think of is the DWTF YW license.
I mean, I think most of the free and open source software licenses that are OSI and OSI approved and FSF recognized as free allow you to generally do whatever you want with them. And then I don't usually recommend that license because it's a problem in that, one, it's often edited out in terms of when you refer to it, and also because it has no disclaimer of warranties.
I see Alana Hashman at the end. Do you want to jump to the front?
Sure.
Great.
Sorry for cutting the line. So I had a question about, you mentioned like this case in which, like, if you have free software and you have a bad actor, like a government or something, like even say a large corporation that then violates the terms of that license, at least it's free, so maybe you can see that happening. What is there to compel them to, like, if they're already breaking the terms of the license or they're doing nefarious things, what is there to compel them to, like, actually make that source code visible to, like, demonstrate that there's a problem?
So a license that requires people don't do nefarious things with technology is not a free license.
Yes.
But if for people who don't follow the terms of the license, we run a way of doing license enforcement as copyright on behalf of copyright holders, and there are various ways that you can do that. It's tougher with governments, but having a public discussion about it is probably one of the first ways to do that.
Thanks.
We have like one more minute, so last question.
Real fast.
Startup.
I control the software development. 4 years I've been able to do open source MIT license.
Is this a legal
license.
Question?
No, it's not legal. I finally got my non-technical colleagues to be okay with open source and champion it. Now I want to make the next move to free, and I'm just wondering if in the last 30 seconds you have any positive ways that you've seen that people have been able to make that last step to like GPL and make normal people think it's okay.
Oh, so this is another example of using free and open differently than I expect. You mean you've been able to do non-copyleft and you want to do copyleft?
Exactly, yeah.
Talking about the long-term business model of the software, using a non-copyleft license or a weak copyleft license can allow your competitors to have a competitive advantage, but using copyleft, if you're releasing the code anyway, releasing it under a strong copyleft license basically levels the playing field. It means that your competitor can't take it, fork it, and then fragment the market.
Awesome, thanks.
Thanks very much.
Thanks.
And we'll be outside if anybody wants to ask more questions.